Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins. We have an esteemed panel joining us today. As I mentioned before the recording, we have kind of the Avengers here of bioethics, and we're so excited to have them. Our first guest is Danielle Pascia. Received her MBE from Harvard Medical School and BA in Bioethics and Interdisciplinary Studies from the University of Alabama. She is currently a research associate at the Hastings Center and is an incoming law student at Yale University. She is interested in high-level questions related to reciprocity, relationality, and solidarity, and how these concepts impact health policy in the United States and inform pathways for improved healthcare access. Our next guest is Sana Babit, who received her MBE from Harvard Medical School and BA in Communication Sciences and Disorders from the University of South Florida. She worked at the Hastings Center for Bioethics for a year as a project manager and research assistant. She is currently a rising second year medical student at UMass Chan Medical School. Her area of interest includes clinical ethics, global health ethics, and social justice. Our next guest is J. Wesley Boyd, who is the Director of Education in the Center for Bioethics at Harvard Medical School. Wes graduated with a BA cum laude from Yale in philosophy. He then attended the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he received an MA in philosophy, a PhD in religion and culture, and a medical degree. Following graduate school and medical school, he completed a residency in psychiatry at Cambridge Hospital, HMS, and completed a fellowship in medical ethics at HMS. His areas of interest include social justice, access to care, human rights, asylum and immigration, humanistic aspects of medicine, physician health and well-being, and substance use. And our last guest is Ryan J. Daugherty. Is a bioethics director at Kaiser Permanente Southern California, where he provides clinical ethics leadership. Ryan graduated from the University of Michigan with a BS in biopsychology, cognition, and neuroscience. He then completed his MSW and PhD in social welfare at the University of California, Los Angeles, with an emphasis on mental health practice and policy. After Ryan completed a fellowship in medical ethics at Weill Cornell Medical College, as a scholar, his work examines how broader social, economic, and political systems construct and shape our responses to bioethical issues in healthcare settings. Let's give a welcome, bioethics welcome to all of our panel for this particular podcast. So we are excited to have you today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course, of course. And of course, as that was a mouthful of bios, and we are excited to have you today. My first question goes to Danielle. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of this article, can you tell us a little bit about how you became interested in the topic of social justice and bioethics?
Thank you so much for that question. I'm really passionate about social justice, and I love talking about how I became interested in it. But first, I just want to quickly say all of our opinions are our own and not that of our institutions before we dive in. So reflecting on the question, how did I first get interested in social justice? I immediately go to my days in college. I think I was exposed to a lot of literature that I previously didn't have ready access to in my hometown in Tennessee, reading the foundational works of people like Ta-Nehisi Coates, Kimberly Crenshaw, Loretta Ross, activists and scholars I really look up to, and I still read their work today, and I'm still inspired by it. And I was also reading this work at a somewhat tumultuous time at the University of Alabama, where there was a lot of debate and discussions over what we do with the Confederate monuments on campus, whether or not we take them down. And there was a lot of debates and activism on campus regarding abortion access in the state of Alabama and on campus at the University of Alabama. So I think reading those works coupled with the political action and discussions happening on campus really solidified my interest and passion for social justice. But I think really the seed of my interest in social justice was really planted very early on in my childhood. I come from a medically underserved Appalachian town. It's a really proud Appalachian community that's extremely tight-knit. And it felt like 1 week I would go to a very typical suburban home in Tennessee. And then the next week I was visiting my friend in a mobile home that didn't even have basic needs like clean running water. I remember my neighbor just down the street, not 5 minutes away, was desperately trying to raise money in order to get a van that was compatible with his son's wheelchair. So I think bearing witness to all of these inequalities and inequities in my hometown made me interested in understanding how we can systematically create a society where people actually can have access to what they need. So distributionally and resource-wise, how can we help people flourish? But also, I think it made me wonder, and it still makes me wonder today when I reflect on my childhood, how can we actually create a society where we relate to each other as equals, and from that relational equality and that drive to want to have that kind of justice in society distribute healthcare needs in such a way that people can truly flourish? Yeah, thank you so much for that question. I'm so passionate about it. And it's so funny in hindsight, looking back, I've been passionate about it for quite some time now.
Thank you, Danielle, for that, for your response. Definitely intriguing. We have Wesley Boyd, and I think the term social justice specifically gets thrown around a lot. It's used in the public discourse a little bit too fluidly. Can you define social justice as you understood it for the purposes of this particular paper?
Sure, absolutely happy to do that. And again, delighted to be here. As Danny said, we're all really excited that you're interested in our paper enough to do this. Social justice for me, bouncing off and amplifying what Danny just said, is really defined as recognizing systemic inequities, things like racism, like what we call now the social determinants of health, et cetera, all of which influence health and healthcare outcomes, especially for marginalized groups. Bioethics historically was really focused on issues pertaining to bedside medicines, for example, respecting patient autonomy or, perhaps fair allocation of scarce resources, such as vaccines early in the pandemic. But social justice is really looking at those things, but from a systemic level, really thinking about systemic issues that affect health and healthcare. And, one of the foundational principles in bioethics is justice. There are the four principles that everyone talks about, for better or for worse. We can debate them up, down, sideways. But, one of the four foundational principles is justice. And if there are social issues which create systemic injustice, as bioethicists, we really need to think about those things. And that, for me, is what thinking about social justice is.
Excellent. Thank you. And before I bring the next question over to my colleague, Dr. Barwise, I do have a question for Ryan. So, together with Joe Finns, you coined the term social bioethics. Can you please define what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to explore this concept. For some context, my training is in social work practice and research. And I remember making the transition over to bioethics, really excited about, I think, what bioethics can offer to healthcare, which is a really clear normative set of tools to decide upon what is and isn't permissible. And at the same time, I was really perplexed because as a social worker, I was trained to think about social systems and how they shape people's experiences, especially as a mental health practitioner, how people relate to themselves, to their communities, to their neighbors, to the world. And so during my first year of my fellowship at Weill Cornell Medicine, I worked really closely with Joseph Finns, thinking about how can we bridge some of the sociological tools that social work uses on the ground with some of the tools that bioethicists use on a day-to-day basis. And so social bioethics is literally the sort of the convergence of sociology and bioethics. At least it's an attempt to do so. Social bioethics asks us to expand our normative reasoning to think about how social, political, and economic systems can underlie our moral reasoning when we're faced with really complex ethical issues. So an example of this, which is something I confront on a really regular basis, is, let's say, for example, complex discharge planning for a patient who might be unhoused or undomiciled. And instead of just getting into the weeds of the problem and understanding what the patient's preferences are and what the treatment team is offering and what resources are available, it's important for me as a bioethicist to take a step back and think about, okay, well, how are systems of poverty perhaps at play here? How might these systems of poverty actually be constraining the options that are available to the treatment team or shaping what the patient is comfortable voicing in terms of their needs? Are we sure that the treatment team really is taking time to understand and appreciate the patient's voice in this type of situation? And similarly, social bioethics asks us to think about how the actions we take might actually reify or reinforce injustice. So it's one thing to say maybe something's permissible or not permissible, but if we don't pay attention to how our recommendations can actually reinforce injustice, sometimes we might take actions that feel perhaps neutral, but actually are not. So when I make a recommendation in my work as a consultant, I think really critically, like, am I playing into any social dynamics here, any social systems that I think that healthcare as a whole has an obligation to essentially avoid or mitigate or disrupt in many ways?
No, absolutely. So in other words, complicity still is an action that could either alleviate the issues or actually exacerbate the issues in social justice overall when it's connected to bioethics. So yeah, absolutely. Great point taken.
So Wesley, you noted in your article, all of you, that feminist bioethics scholars have been advocating for the incorporation of social justice in the field of bioethics for a long time. So how did you all come together then and undertake this study at this specific juncture?
Well, thanks for the question. Our research actually was prompted by both Danny and Sana reaching out to me. Danny and Sana had both been my students at Harvard Medical School in the bioethics master's program, and were both at Hastings Center when they reached out to me and said, you know, we're really interested in this issue of social justice. And we started brainstorming and put our heads together to say, you know, what might we do in this space? And I forget exactly how it all came about, but we thought, oh, let's look at what bioethicists think around the country in North America about what their duties are pertaining to social justice. And I was at Baylor College of Medicine at the time. So I'd been at Harvard a long time, went down to Houston, and then I'm now back at Harvard. But I was at Baylor College of Medicine, and Ryan was one of my colleagues, as was Faith Fletcher, who's also a co-author on the paper. And so, you know, in the face of issues or recent events like Black Lives Matter, like COVID-19, which basically, you know, among many other things, laid bare the huge inequities in our healthcare system, we felt like we had a moral obligation to go forward with a study like this. So I brought in colleagues from Baylor, as I said, and we set about deciding to query bioethicists about what they thought their duties were. With respect for example, to social justice. So, you know, Black bioethicists have played a pivotal role in broadening the field's understanding of concepts like justice, underscoring interconnectedness of issues like sexism, racism, et cetera, and other forms of oppression in healthcare, especially systemic racism and oppression. And we felt like we wanted to see whether or not the issues that we felt passionate about were shared with bioethicists around the country and in North America.
Well, it's obviously a wonderful collaboration, so congratulations. Sana, let's kind of get into the details of the paper now. So if we understand correctly from what you described, you use an iterative process while you were developing your survey, and you had a multidisciplinary team, obviously, from different institutions, and then you piloted your survey. Did anything surprise you as you were beginning to sort of develop the survey in that process?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a really critical step in the survey development. And in the early stages of the process, we recognized that how we frame our questions would shape not only the kind of data we collected, but also how participants would interpret foundational concepts like justice and advocacy. So this iterative process became absolutely essential to make sure that we were going to be able to capture the data that we were interested in a way that minimized any bias that we brought in with it. So with that in mind, we really wanted to make sure that the individuals piloting the survey would represent the kind of diversity that we see in the field of bioethics. So across as many different disciplinary backgrounds as we could get and across as many different kinds of institutions as we could access. So we really could not have done this without like the contribution of all our collaborators and our co-authors, it's especially the ones who are not on this episode. Shout out to Dr. Faith Fletcher, Dr. Zamina Mathani-Aziz, and Jane Fallis Cooper, who were absolutely essential in the process and in this project. And ultimately, I think this process really helped us focus our questions and really cemented the importance of intentionality and transparency in our survey design.
Danielle, can you outline what sort of questions you eventually came up with? And you used a United Nations list of social justice related topics. So why did you choose that? And can you explain to our listeners a little bit more about what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for asking. Beyond the really obvious socio-demographic questions that we asked, I think the kinds of questions that we asked can be separated into three buckets. The first being, we wanted to ask people how much they thought their work was social justice. So descriptively, how would they describe the extent to which they engage with social justice right now? Secondly, we wanted to ask participants about impact. What kind of impact did they think was appropriate for the field of bioethics? And what kinds of activism or advocacy are within the bounds or remit of the field? And finally, we wanted to ask them questions broadly about what they thought bioethics was in relationship to social justice. Did they think that bioethicists had a duty to engage with writing for lay audiences? Did they think that bioethics should engage in something like civil disobedience? So I think those were sort of the three buckets that we asked participants in the survey. In terms of the United Nations topics, we really tried to comb the internet for a list that felt like it encapsulated the topics normally associated with social justice initiatives and scholarship. And we wanted to make sure that we just didn't create a list out of thin air. And so I think that's where the United Nations list came from. In a similar vein, speaking to the literature review that Sana and I did with the team, we looked through the vast amount of literature, because there's actually been quite a bit published about social justice related actions in bioethics. So we looked through these articles and we made note, and we tried to systematically go through these articles, choosing where authors had specifically noted civil disobedience or where we had obligations for writing for lay audiences. And we found a wide array of those. We put them into the list, and those are the ones that made it into the survey ultimately. So for the social justice topics in particular, we actually had a lot of literature to draw from, which was great.
So it sounds like the whole process, even before you disseminated your survey, took quite a while. How long did all that take?
It was quite a bit of prep work. And again, I think it's great that Sana pointed this out. This is a survey that truly felt like everybody on the team was needed because everybody brought such a rich range of experience and citations and references that they had. Dr. Faith Fletcher, who couldn't be on the call today, actually was pivotal in framing the survey in terms of social justice. So it was, yeah, it was quite a bit of prep work looking again at the vast and deep work that feminist bioethicists, Black bioethicists have done previously in the field and making sure that we not only acknowledge that work in the survey, but we actually substantively try and embed it into how we are asking and framing these survey questions.
Like, just to amplify that, I don't recall exactly how long it took, but I bet you it was the better part of 10 months or possibly even a year between the time Danny and Sana and I started talking and we eventually disseminated the survey. And as Danny said, you know, Faith Fletcher was absolutely critical to this entire iterative process. But I also, we reached out, Danny, Sana, and I reached out to two other former students of mine, Jane Cooper and Zamina Mithani, whose names you just heard, with whom I had written a couple of pieces pertaining to Black Lives Matter and COVID-19 and issues pertaining to social justice. So their perspectives also just really broadened everything we thought about. And to repeat what Danny said, you know, we started to come up with a list for ourselves of topics pertaining to social justice, but then we saw this list that was already there from the UN, and we're like, you know, why reinvent the wheel, essentially? And so it was good enough for our purposes, and that's why we used it.
So Ryan, it looks like you had a pretty good completion rate on your survey. So about 75% of people who opened it, or about 75% of people answered at least one question. As with all surveys, how representative do you think the sample was? You know, were there any people that you didn't expect to answer it that answered it, or people that you thought would answer it that, you know, you think maybe didn't answer it?
Yeah, thanks for this question. As a research methods person, this is a really important question, and one that's, I think, both easy and really difficult to answer. I think we have really good reason to believe that the survey is quite representative of professional bioethicists in the United States and Canada today. The distribution that we saw of demographics was quite similar to other surveys distributed to bioethicists in recent years. So there's the, for example, the AJOB piece by Pearson and colleagues looking at the views of bioethicists today. But of course, there are always limitations to research methods. And I think one limitation of survey methodology, especially for, I think, the topic area of social justice, is both self-selection bias and social desirability bias. So social desirability bias is, of course, when people answer surveys, there is a moment where they respondents have a moment where they can sort of filter or change how they actually feel about a particular question in order to represent themselves in a positive light. So, you know, there's the risk that, of course, maybe some respondents actually feel less favorable towards social justice, or maybe conversely want to come across as more negative towards social justice than what actually is true for them. And the other, of course, is something that we really grappled with, which is both, I think it's a self-selection bias, like which bioethicists are interested enough in taking a survey on social justice, and did that influence who and who didn't take the survey, but also like who is a bioethicist? We distributed the survey quite broadly to professional listservs that both Americans and Canadians are active on, but who constitutes as a bioethicist, I think, is something we really had to grapple with. Bioethicists work in research settings, private and public settings. Some work full time. Some work as a consultant, maybe a couple hours out of the year as part of their full-time job. Some are retired and are still really active. And of course, some are in fellowship programs or in graduate school, or perhaps are doing rounds and getting introduced to this work in undergrad. And so I think one thing that we really had to grapple with is, who do we want to include in the survey? Who really counts as a bioethicist? And which bioethicists are really important in the communities they work in, but perhaps aren't interested in being active or a participant on some of these broader professional networks? So I think these are issues that aren't specific to our research alone. I think this is something that has been talked about in relation to a lot of other research done recently on bioethicists. But I think, you know, in general, I'll say we are really happy with our sample size of 399 participants. And we were quite pleased to see that the distribution of the demographics is similar to other research projects, kind of indicating that we really, I think, hit the mark as best we could in terms of getting a representative population.
Yeah, fantastic. Congratulations. Kurt, I'll hand it back to you for a bit.
And this question is for Danielle and Ryan. So what were the main findings of your article? And did these findings surprise you? And also, just to make sure, I know this is going to be in our caption for this particular podcast, but the specific article we're talking about is from the American Journal of Bioethics, Empirical Bioethics, and the title of the article is A Survey of Attitudes Towards Social Justice Obligations in the Field of Bioethics. So for our listeners out there who are like, what article, what's the title, and where can we find it? That's the information for you right there. But yeah, Daniel and Ryan, what did you come across that was interesting in your findings?
Yeah, just to go over what I see as the three main findings, even though if you look at the article, there is quite a bit of data there. So we found that 80% in terms of our survey participants believe bioethics should incorporate social justice concerns in their work. I actually found this to be quite surprising. I wasn't expecting that much of a majority. So just speaking to what findings surprised you, I thought that 80% was quite striking. Around 75% think bioethics scholarship should advance social justice, and over 57% view social activism as a central role in their bioethics work. We also sought to understand what kinds of actions are most endorsed by people working in bioethics. And to me, this was one of the most interesting findings related to the survey. Unsurprisingly, writing for lay audiences was quite endorsed, while actions such as whistleblowing were less endorsed. That's, I think, not too surprising. I think we could have hypothesized that that is how participants answered, but I found it really interesting nonetheless to be able to capture that data in this project. Ryan, did you want to speak more to the regressions?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing we were really interested in was, you know, we have results that look at the summary of how participants were thinking about their obligations towards social justice. But one thing we were interested in looking at is like who's doing this work and what is the relationship between sociodemographics and attitudes as well as behaviors, or at least self-reported behaviors in terms of who's engaging in social justice work. So we have a few tables that look at bivariate relationships, that is the relationship between two different types of variables, as well as multiple regressions, which are analyses that allow us to look at how the combination of several different factors work together to predict a single variable. And some of our key findings found that early career bioethicists are more likely to think that a key aim of bioethics scholarship should advance social justice and directly impact society. Of course, this isn't like a binary. So there are, of course, mid and later career bioethicists who also endorse this. But by and large, in our multiple regression, we found that early career status predicted endorsing this particular item. We also similarly found that folks reported that the institutions they work for strongly influence their social justice commitments. Now, this can be interpreted in either direction. So it could be the case that institutions are playing a pivotal role in facilitating the types of social justice work that folks are doing, maybe through mentorships or work opportunities or funding mechanisms and grants. And it could also be the case that folks are identifying institutions as a barrier to doing social justice work. Perhaps policies or cultural norms that make people feel like they need to restrict their more visibly social justice work, which would be concordant with another finding that we had found, where folks were listing states or provinces that they live in, if they felt like those states or provinces were restricting their ability to engage in social justice work. The other major multiple regression looked at how people endorse the item. In my own work in bioethics, advocacy and social activism play a role. And I think there were two major findings from this. So we found that age was a significant predictor, meaning the younger the age, the more likely that the participant was likely to endorse this item about advocacy and social activism playing a central role in their work. So it's very concordant with our other finding about career status. We similarly found that, again, people endorse the role of institutions in influencing their social justice commitments. And similarly, and I think this last one is less surprising, folks who believed that a key aim of bioethics scholarship should be to advance social justice were more likely to incorporate social justice in their own day-to-day work, which of course makes a lot of sense. If you have the attitude, you're more likely to have the behavior. So I think in summary, we had some really nice findings around age and career status, which I think has really interesting implications for early career scholars who might be more vulnerable, less secure in their career status, or might have less protections from their institutions, which I think is a really important finding, especially right now.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ryan, for that context. And also, and I know that Ryan touched a little bit on this, but this question is for Sana. So the interesting aspects of your particular work is that things like health equity, racism, and disability ethics were endorsed more frequently, while things like climate change, water, sanitation, you know, things that, you know, conflict prevention, things of that sort, were not really as popular. What are your interpretations of that based off of your findings?
Yeah, so this was one of the findings I found really interesting. And in some ways, I think we expected health equity to be highly endorsed. It aligns with how bioethics has historically developed, especially in relation to the clinical encounter. Bioethics has historically centered itself at the bedside, and health equity fits, I think, quite seamlessly into that framework, especially as we come to understand how structural and social determinants shape health outcomes long before we get to the bedside. And health equity is also a very broad topic, and it encompasses a lot of existing and emerging issues. But when we saw that areas like climate change, water and sanitation, and conflict prevention were less frequently endorsed, I don't interpret that as a reflection of their irrelevance to bioethics. Rather, I think it speaks more to our positionality. So, for instance, I might not think that water and sanitation is extremely relevant to my job as a bioethicist, but I think there's a high chance that a bioethicist in, say, Flint, Michigan would see it as central. Similarly, conflict prevention might feel very distant from my work, but for those who are in regions affected by political violence or displacement, it's inseparable from the questions of human health and well-being. And so in many ways, these findings tell us more about the current landscape of bioethics in North America than about the intrinsic significance or relevance of these issues in bioethics. And so while the survey gives us a nice snapshot of how bioethicists in North America are thinking about these issues, it does invite us to consider how these views might look very different in other parts of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Wherever your context is, you know, that's and whatever is affecting you where you are geographically, obviously you're going to have more attention in those particular areas and issues compared to other individuals that might have other issues that they're trying to resolve, 1,500 miles away. So yeah, absolutely makes sense. Yeah. Great. Thank you, Sana. Also, this question is for Ryan. So do you have any suggestions on how we can encourage institutional support given the current political climate? I know that's a very heavy loaded question, and I could open it up to everyone else other than Ryan, needless to say. But what are not just Ryan, actually, we could open it up as well. But what are your thoughts on that, granted the current political climate?
I'm really happy that you opened the floor for everybody, because I'll say this. I think one of the most important things we can do right now is rely on each other's wisdom. I think every state, every county, every city, every institution, every job has really different things at stake, different types of, kind of taking the social bioethics lens, different types of pressures that might shape who can do what kind of work and when and who can say what. Working in Texas right now looks very different than working in, let's say, California. And I think that there is a long tradition in academia, especially from scholars who have marginalized identities and backgrounds, and how to navigate times like these, who to turn to, how to frame certain research, how to take care of yourself, how to advocate for yourself. And I think at a bare minimum, we can't be working in silos at this moment. We need to put our heads together to think about how to strategize, how to survive, how to thrive in doing this type of work. So, you know, as for institutions, I mean, I think that's one type of question. But, you know, one thing I did impress upon your listeners is, like, what are you doing to support one another in this time? Is your office door metaphorically open? Do you have ways to meet and convene with other scholars doing this type of work to share strategies and ideas? I mean, I think these are the types of things that we needed to be doing. Right now is really bad, but I think it's always been really difficult to do this kind of work, not to minimize, I think, the uniqueness of this moment, but just to say there's a lot of wisdom out there. And I think that we would all really benefit through really intentional collaboration, sharing ideas and resources.
Yeah, if I could amplify some of what Ryan just said, as I said earlier, this study was a long time in the making. And I think when Danny and Sana and I first started talking about it, we had no idea that we would be living in the current political climate that we're in right now, where even talking about diversity, equity, inclusion is like forbidden. And, you know, universities are capitulating to a really abusive administration proactively, you know, even before they're told, you know, you need to eliminate this kind of program, or you can't talk about this, or you can't hire these kinds of people. And so, you know, we feel, I don't want to speak for everybody. I feel like the findings in our paper are more important now than ever, because social justice is being full on attacked by the current administration.
Okay, great. So my last question is for Danielle. And of course, and the first half is for Danielle, and the second half is for all of our wonderful panelists for this episode. So the first question for Danielle is, it's like the so what question, right? Okay, so what? What are, you know, the key takeaways does this article have for the field? And then for the rest of the panelists, what are your responses to, you know, critics who say, you know what, you're being a little bit too subjective, right? Social justice and bioethics should not have a relationship with subjectivity. You have to be more objective. I'm sure we heard that argument plenty of times. So I'm interested to hear everyone's response to individuals that might say that regarding your article. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, the survey is really helpful because it gives us a snapshot that's data-backed. But I will say that there is so much scholarship out there that can tell us what we can do next in terms of actionable steps to help the field become more social justice oriented. If you haven't already read it, I really suggest reading the special report, A Critical Moment in Bioethics. It is free to access. You can find it on the Hastings Center website. So many people such as Keisha Ray, Dr. Faith Fletcher, Dr. Patrick Smith contributed greatly to that, Dr. Claretta Dupree. And it's just an amazing work of bioethics that can actually give us concrete steps in how to move forward. I also want to point to an article that I cite quite a bit, which is from Rachel Fabi and Daniel Goldberg, which talks about funding asymmetries in the field. What kind of work are we funding in the field? Is it largely genomics work? Is it work that talks about how important water and sanitation is for social determinants of health? So I think, you know, we can rely on some of the prior work that's been done to think through next steps and what needs to be done in terms of concretely implementing social justice into the field. But I think for me, a takeaway that I have that still needs to be litigated and questioned is, what does impact mean within the field of bioethics? And what kinds of impact should be expected of bioethicists and people who work in the field? And then I think the next step after that is, how can we support bioethicists that want to do this work when early career scholars go up for tenure? What things are valued? So I think going back to those foundational questions is important. And I just want to say that Sun and I, as we were co-leading this project together, were so incredibly lucky to work with people that we not only genuinely look up to. So Dr. Wesley Boyd, Dr. Ryan Dougherty, Dr. Faith Fletcher, Jane Cooper, Dr. Mithani, but we felt supported by them. And so speaking to what Ryan was saying earlier, just making sure that we hold space for each other, that we support each other. I know from the beginning, Dr. Boyd not only helped fund this project, but was an incredible thought partner in making sure that Sun and I felt comfortable exploring this idea. And we didn't feel belittled or that it was too big of a project to take on, even though there was zero funding for it. So I just wanted to make sure I amplify the team even more and say that Sun and I are very fortunate that we had this team to work with. And we felt incredibly supported throughout this process. And I want to see more of that in the field.
You know, I'll come back to what I said before in response to your question, you know, how do we respond to critics who say, in essence, bioethics ought to be more objective and ought not take stances regarding social issues? I come back to thinking again about the, you know, basic bioethical principles that we all learn in Bioethics 101, one of which is justice, and then the others, beneficence and non-maleficence. If there are things out there in the environment, in the social environment, that are causing harm to our patients, you know, bad air, for example, exposure to gun violence, I could go on and on and on. These are potentially harmful to our patients, of course, and they're also justice issues. If there is injustice out there, then I feel like bioethicists have a duty to speak out against those injustices as they pertain to our patients' health. If we're bioethicists and we take our job seriously, then we can't turn our backs on systemic issues that are harming our patients.
I totally agree with what Wes has said here. I think, you know, I turn to feminist philosopher Sandra Harding and her concept of hard objectivity, this idea that there really isn't a thing out there that exists that we can probably point to that's sort of value neutral objectivity. Whenever we engage in the world, we're and interpreting problems, we're bringing with us a set of biases, lived experiences, power or maybe our experiences with marginalization and oppression. So when I hear these critiques that like somehow social justice like dilutes our ability to do some sort of like normative analysis, I think it really misconstrues what social justice can offer us, which is actually a way of revealing and accounting for how systems are always actively at play within us, with our interactions with others. And in fact, I think through that, we become actually more objective. We're able to work on problems with a deeper appreciation and understanding. Like when I go into a room and I'm working with a patient or maybe a physician who has a totally different set of identities, lived experiences, values, and I account for the fact that maybe I'm different, I have different lived experiences and different ways of thinking, and I use different terms or concepts or frameworks, I actually am equipping myself to be a better listener, to like actually take time to account for that difference and ask the right types of questions to make sure I really deeply understand who this person is, what is the ethical problem, and what can I do to resolve this issue in a way that actually doesn't impose my own values or my privilege onto the situation. And so that's my long-winded way of saying I think social justice actually enhances our objectivity by not turning a blind eye to, I think, things that are always active and can be really harmful if we're not thinking about them.
Yeah, and just playing off of what everyone has said so far, I mean, I think the work that we do at Bioethics, it lends itself to a continuation of talking about social justice and looking at these things. If we're going through these different issues and looking at the ethics, looking at areas that we have difficulty with and challenges, and we identify injustice in these issues and areas that, you know, we have a breach in the ethics and the rights of individuals, I think it is a disservice to not continue that work in a form of action, in a form that can actually further benefit and improve people's lives and health and well-being. And I think just on an extremely pragmatic level, like it fits, it works. And for a lot of the work that we do, it's a really important continuation and part of it.
Well, thank you all, you know, for writing this and doing this work. I think it's amazing to draw attention to social justice within bioethics. It's extremely important. That's why we have our podcast as well. And we've been talking about this topic and sort of how we can introduce our students to it. And so I think this article is a great way for them to, you know, start to think about this. So thank you all for your work. And thank you all for being here today. It was great to have so many of you. And congrats to you and all your co-authors.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure being here. As I've told my students, Danny, Sana, Jane, who's not here, and Zamina also, many times, you know, many academic papers get read. I'm exaggerating slightly, but they get read by exactly three people. They get read by the author themselves, the editor of the journal, and then the reviewer. And so fortunately, I've never needed to write papers in order to keep my job. And so when I write papers, I write them because I actually care about the topic and I want our findings to be noticed and discussed. And so a forum like this is just a pure pleasure and joy for me. Thank you so much.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.